It always strikes me as a little odd when we hear a passage like today's lesson from St. Luke and we just automatically say, "Glory and praise to you, Lord God." It's not really happy language. No, we talk about the gospel as being good news. Doesn't sound like good news to me. But you see, that's part and parcel of the gospel. Some people say, there's an old proverb, there's two sides to every coin. Well, there are two sides to the gospel as well, and they're not in opposition to each other. That's the danger we follow on, that somehow if we hear a message which isn't what we think ought to be there, that somehow the gospel is contradicting itself. And when it seems that way, what we need to do is step back from it for a moment and see, how do we weave this all together? Because if there are two sides to the same coin, it is the same coin. It doesn't change value because you've turned it over. So we hear these words of Jesus today, and they're not happy words. I mean, his disciples are remarking how beautiful the temple is, and Jesus pauses for a moment and he looks as well, and then he tells them, "See all of this? It's going to be all falling down." Now, to get a real sense of how dramatic that was, you need to understand just a little bit about what this building was that they were looking at. You know, the first temple was built by King Solomon years and years, hundreds of years before the time of Jesus. And that's not what they're looking at, because that temple was destroyed when the people of Israel were carried off into exile into Babylon, and they returned to build yet another temple. And actually, the one that they're looking at is probably, for all practical purposes, the third temple on that site. This is the temple of Herod the Great. You have to understand about Herod a little bit. You know, we hear Herod in the beginning of Luke's gospel, actually in the beginning of Matthew's gospel, excuse me, when the wise men come and they tell Herod that, there's a king born in Israel, and we know him for what we normally call the slaughter of the holy innocents, when he wipes out all the male children of 2 years and under, afraid because he might be his replacement. So he wants to make sure they're all gone. But Herod ruled in that region for quite a while, and in fact, he was quite the master builder. That's how he got the title Herod the Great. Herod the Great. We don't think of him as great because of that awful thing that he did in the context of our Christmas stories, but in reality, he was one who built up that nation, even as he was complicit with Roman authorities to keep it under the care of the emperor, but he was a pretty savvy politician. And he was able to please the emperor by making this a very productive and economically viable colony of the Roman Empire. And so he was king, and as long as the area, we'll call it Palestine, was productive and gave lots of taxes back to Rome, they were just as happy to leave their hands off of it and leave it all to Herod. And one of the ways in which Herod did this was to build beautiful and magnificent public works. In fact, he built a couple of harbors along the coast of Palestine. And when he did that, he improved yet even again the economic viability of this country, because now it was a place where people would come with their ships and they would unload them, and kind of like the longshoremen of their day, they would be able to take all of this produce off the ships, and they, of course, all of that would be taxed along the way, and some of that tax would go to Rome. Everybody was very happy with all of this. Being the savvy politician that he was, Herod also knew that he had to keep his people happy. Now, if there was anything about the people of Judah at that time, they were a fairly religious people. So how do you keep religious people happy? You build them a magnificent place to worship. So he built the temple. The temple that Jesus is describing and the temple that is making the disciples just stand in awe. Now, by modern standards, it probably wasn't all that big or tremendous, but by the standards of the ancient world, it was an immense building. You can get some sense of the scale of it, that there's only one wall that still remains. We call it, you might know it, as the Wailing Wall. It's where people go and pray and put their prayers, the little prayer cards or slips of paper into the wall. And it's all massive stones and so on. You wonder, how did they do that? Kind of like when you see the pyramids, you go like, how did they do that? They didn't have cranes. We know them. They didn't have trucks and all kinds of steam-powered engines and things to make all of this stuff easy. No, they did it all by hand. In fact, the pillars in the temple were made of solid granite. And they were long. They were tens of feet long and high once they were erected. They were holding up mighty walls and mighty roofs. The temple itself wasn't even just a plain old building. The temple itself was adorned, it says. There were adornments on the temple. That sounds kind of nice. It's kind of like trinkets on a Christmas tree. That's not what we're talking about. And the temple, for example, one of the adornments was this immense chain that looked like a vine, and on the vine there were clusters of grapes. To give you some sense of size, the scholars conjecture from the time of the temple, Josephus the historian describes it as the cluster of grapes was as tall as a man. So you get some sense of the grandeur and the size of this. And this is all hanging all about. Not only, and that was all there, and not only was it there, it was covered in gold. And then you look at the walls of the temple. You begin to realize that it's not just stone. It's covered in gold. So much so that as the sun moved across the sky during the day, the reflection of the sun would make this beacon for others to see. At the top of the Mount of Zion, as we often call the hills in Jerusalem, there is the great temple, and it is a marvelous thing to behold. It truly is awesome. Now, we get a little bit of that here. Once in a while, somebody will come into the office during the week, and they've seen this church on this street corner for all of these years, and they'll want to come in and kind of look at it, so they'll knock on the door, they'll come in, and they'll say, can we just go into the church? And usually, be sure, you know, so Lisa or myself or Terry, when he's around, and so on, will bring people over to the church. And the universal experience, almost 100%, is when we open those white doors, because they're white on the other side, they're usually closed during the week, you open it up and they walk in, and the first thing they go is, wow, what a beautiful place. That's the kind of thing these disciples are doing. They've come to Jerusalem, these country rubes that grew up, you know, in the north country of Galilee and all over the place. They're not city folk, they're not the Jerusalem types, so they've probably not been to the temple, or at least that close. Jesus is taking them on a field trip. They're marveling at what they see. Takes their breath away. And you know what that Jesus has the chutzpah to do? He says, don't get so concerned about it. All of this is going to be torn down stone by stone by stone. Now think about it. Herod took all those years and all of those resources to build this mighty temple, and Jesus, this little country preacher, comes along and says, oh, don't worry about it. It's all going to fall down. He's not making very many friends by saying that. Probably the temple police are hearing this, and some, they're reporting it up to the big bosses in the Sanhedrin, and so all of a sudden the murmuring about this Jesus person is starting to go around, you know, and so that's how he starts to be seen sort of as a rabble-rouser, a troublemaker, even a traitor, or something, or somebody that they could use the Romans to get rid of. There's this Jesus, and he says, it's all going to fall down. Jesus has a profound insight there. Actually, I would tell you, it's probably not all that profound an insight, because Luke, after all, writing his story about Jesus long after the temple had already fallen down. In 70 AD, the Romans came in, and they were fed up with all of the stuff that was going on in Palestine, so they came in and they burned it down. They set fire to it, and all the wooden supports, and it just all collapsed in and on itself, except for the Wailing Wall. And that lasts even to this day, thousands of years later. So it did all fall down. It already was down when Luke is writing this story, but he's not necessarily all that concerned that Jesus is somehow foretelling the future, that he's someone like a psychic who kind of can tell what's going to happen in a few days or a few years. That's not what he's about at all. He does, though, use this story to tell us something profound about what Jesus understands and what Jesus wants us to know. And that is simply that the things of this world do not last. Even this beautiful building in which we find ourselves today, one of these days, it will be gone. We don't want to think about that. We don't want to even conjecture that it's possible. In fact, we take lots of resources to make sure that it stays up. And generation after generation, this is being done. But the reality is, whether it's tomorrow or in 5 weeks or in 5 years or in 50 years or in 500 years, or maybe even at the end of the world when we are just sucked up into the sun, it will disappear. Nothing in this world is permanent. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to us. So that if we start investing ourselves and our existence and our worth and our dignity in the things of this world, we will lose our souls. So Jesus is trying to tell his disciples, don't do that. Don't get so wrapped up in all of this splendor that you forget why you are being called. Because if you are truly my disciples and you follow the path that I am laying before you, you will be called before the authorities of this world and you will be punished. You will be thrown into cells, into jails. You will be persecuted. And in the midst of all of that, Jesus has, again, this guy's got some mind, He's, don't worry about it. Because not a hair on your head will perish. Not a hair on your head will, well, mine are going away faster than I want to realize that. I'm sure there are many in this room also that are kind of experiencing that same thing. So I'm going, well, what do you mean by that? And I think what Jesus means is something so insignificant as a hair on your head that it will not suffer eternal death and destruction if you are faithful. We're not really talking about the physical hair on our heads. He's talking about our very lives. Because the things that are really important and the things that are eternal and the things that will last forever are not the things of this world. They are not the stones and the beautiful surroundings that we build, but rather it is what we build within us. It is the very fabric of who we are in our hearts. It is what relationship we have with God. And in that God, what relationship we have with one another. These are the things that last. These are the things that can conquer even death itself. These are the bonds that tie us together. These are the things that make us love. These are the things where we need not stone or glass or gold of any sort. We can be the poorest of the poor and still be rich in the things of the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is telling his disciples, don't invest yourselves in all of this. Because if this is what you think it's all about, you will lose your soul. But my brothers and sisters, the most telling line is the last. If you invest yourselves in the things of the kingdom of God, if you put your hearts in the right place, and if you keep focus and attention on what really lasts and what really is eternal, you will find your souls. You will discover who you truly are. You will discover and realize in your heart of hearts that you are a child of God and that nothing in this world can prevail against you, not even the powers of this world. Because even if they destroy the body, Jesus teaches us, it is our spirit, it is our soul that lasts forever. And all we need to do is to cling to Jesus. Well, that's all very dramatic, isn't it? Well, it happens not only at the end of the world or in such drama as a great persecution. It can happen day in and day out. You know, life throws a lot of curveballs at us. Sometimes it's a terrible illness. Sometimes it's betrayal by a friend, as Jesus described it. Betrayal by a member of our family. Sometimes it's simply the fact that life happens and we don't know what to do with it. Thomas Dorsey is a great hymn writer. And he was well known, particularly for spirituals that he wrote. And he was quite prolific, and he was very well known, and people wanted him to lead music at great revivals. And so he was called one day, and he was going to leave his home and leave his wife, pregnant wife, actually, behind, and go up to Chicago to do a great revival there. And as he was there, he received word that his wife was to deliver their baby. And shortly after, he received word that she had died in the process. So he leaves everything what he's doing and he rushes home, only to find that a day or two later, he loses his son as well, this new child. Inconsolate, his world was falling down. The mighty bricks that he had built up around him were all now being torn down one by one. All the things that were valuable to him as he perceived them, they were gone. And he could not find in himself the strength to go on. And one day, he was sitting, depressed, inconsolable. And suddenly, a melody came to him, and words to fit that melody. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord. Lead me on. That's what Jesus is talking about. When we finally let go and realize we don't have all the answers, that our words don't really make a lot of difference. When we are unable even to speak, the Spirit of God will fill us and will give us the words we need whenever and wherever we are. So this lesson is not about great edifices, really, great buildings. It's about us. It's about us to make sure that we keep focus on that which is eternal and that which is most important, our relationship to God and to one another. And when we need the words, we will find them. When we need God, God will be there. When we need you, we will find our soul.